Welcome to the Watchers of the Skies program. I'm Carlos Campo, president here at Ashland University and Theological Seminary, joined as always, or nearly always, by my friend and colleague, Dennis Montecruces. Dennis, how are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
You know, this is our last programming day after 3 years, and I know we're both grateful to both Dave McCoy, who's leading the department here at Journalism and Digital Media at Ashland University, John Scrotta, phenomenal staffer who is a jack of all trades, who's been at Ashland for a number of years as well and supported us not only on the show but in many other ways. And, of course, the students who are here, Michaela running the show, Will, Michael Brin, and Madison, who goes by Maddie's from Highland Heights and says Condados Mexican Restaurant is the best place to go if you happen to be visiting. But a little bit of nostalgia on today's show, Dennis. We're going to query one another on what difference does it make? You know, this idea of what's the most important thing for a student to learn and what are these areas of study? I know we are friends with the ACTA group. They're the American Council of Trustees and Alumni. They ask the question, what will they learn? And they give a letter grade to every college and university based upon what requirements undergraduate students have at their college or university. And one of the areas they think should be a requirement is philosophy, of all things, and English as well. So here are our two fields. And so we hoped that our listeners and watchers might be interested in hearing directly from us, what difference does it make? What business does anyone have studying philosophy? My goodness, there's nothing more abjectly opposed to the sorry, Dennis. I'm starting off.
We're starting over. Yes.
Yeah, that's right. No second takes on this show. Live television right here. But what about it, Dennis? You've heard this. You've been a philosopher your whole life. Last time I looked, we probably don't have more than 10 or 12 philosophy majors at Ashland, despite a number of undergraduates studying with us. If you were to talk to a young student thinking about philosophy, what do you say to the student? What do you say to the parent? What difference does it make majoring in philosophy? Why is it something that should be a requirement for more colleges and universities?
Right. Well, to be honest, I'm not sure that I would tell anyone that they should be a philosophy major.
Okay.
But studying philosophy is a different thing.
All right.
So many universities for a long time, so Catholic universities used to require just a huge heaping of courses in philosophy.
Right, at least three or four, I think.
I mean, I think even more than that at one point. I mean, maybe as many as like five or six.
Really?
I mean, so really a significant number. When I was doing PhD work at Fordham in the 90s, I think it was down to two at that point. Mm. And I'm not even sure if that survived. I mean, certainly in many universities it hasn't.
Right.
I think at UNLV when we were there also, maybe it was two.
Two.
At the time, right. So, philosophy, it's such a huge field. I mean, and not only that, but many academic fields emerge from philosophy as well. Mm-hmm. But even so, still what's left in philosophy proper is still an enormous subject matter. What's valuable about philosophy, I would say, very broadly speaking, where there should be some requirement, I think there's two areas. So one is just logic / critical thinking. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of universities will still have a critical thinking requirement.
Yes.
Even if it's not officially under philosophy, it might be under English or communications or some other.
Several fields courses would fulfill that, but philosophy would be among them.
And even within critical thinking, or let's say logic broadly speaking, there's both kind of the general critical thinking, which is reading a text and being able to kind of understand the text, trace whatever arguments being made and so on. And then there's a more formal logic. And formal logic still survives, let's say, if you're a computer science major, you end up taking it.
Right.
There's usually like a baby formal logic and a more advanced formal logic course that is not only useful, but it's essential in computer science, but very important for some ways of doing philosophy as well. But it's also, again, a discipline of thought that's extremely useful. So I think, those three courses, at least the baby formal logic course, along with critical thinking, is really essential. So again, it's how to approach a text, how to be able to follow an argument in a close and careful way. So it's not just a matter of, this person's conclusion differs from what I believe, so it's wrong, and maybe I'm going to go hunting around for why it's wrong or something like that. But to be able to recognize, even when the argument supports the conclusions that you like, if it's a bad argument, it's a bad argument.
Right.
Right. So to have both the skill to identify that and the self-discipline to look, right? Those are enormously valuable components to studying philosophy. And then the other aspect of philosophy, which I think is extremely important, and definitely, well, absent from almost every curriculum, is to know the history of philosophy. Hmm. Not because it matters that, okay, this person said this in philosophy of substance, but that there are these broad ideas that have influenced society, mm-hmm. right? So there are all these things that we learn even as little kids. So I've mentioned before in previous programs the fact-value distinction, right? That here are facts, right? Yes. Here are things that we can require that a student believes, that we expect every moderately educated person in society to believe.
And these are diminishing, Dennis. Facts are diminishing.
This is true. Right? This is true. But I mean, at least for a long time, it's considered. Right, that, okay, you know, the sciences, right, they say, believe this, right, these are historical facts. This stuff is sound, solid. Yes. We can expect you to believe this to be any kind of a credible person in society. And over here is opinion, and that includes religious belief, ethical beliefs, or at least beliefs about what's right and what's wrong.
Right.
And things of this sort, values, you know, beauty, things that you would be concerned with in literature.
Certainly.
So we just take this as just as obvious as ABCs almost. But no, it's not obvious that there really is this distinction. But this is something that came out of one particular philosophical movement, you know, in the Enlightenment. So we're influenced in all kinds of ways that we're just not aware of. So people say, well, my philosophy is, and then they offer some kind of, you know, just brief kind of statement of, you know, a way that they think we should live life. Well, it's not really your philosophy. I mean, you may own it, but in the sense that it's not something you made up, that we're just influenced without realizing it by really the history of philosophy. And so, like, there's little pastiches of this and that. And so to be aware of that and to see, here's how, you know, we got from point A to point B in terms of what we believe individually and as a society.
I think you make some excellent points there. Maybe just take us to the root of the word. So what does the word philosophy mean? And what's the question? I say the question. When you study philosophy, early philosophers, Aristotle, Socrates, asked kind of one fundamental question. Maybe talk about how that fundamental question then plays out both in a curricular approach to higher education and then just as a foundation for life.
Right. So philosophy, I mean, it's a compound Greek word. So philo is going to be love.
Yes.
Like Philadelphia is the city of brotherly love.
Right.
And Sophia is wisdom. So it's the love of wisdom. And so the early philosophers, and I think the first time the term philosopher is used is for Pythagoras.
Hmm.
So around 5th century BC. So he's before Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle.
Right.
And of course, we know him from the Pythagorean theorem, but mm-hmm. he actually was a philosopher in kind of the guru-ish sense, really. Mm-hmm. But so they're concerned not only by any means, but let's say the foundational concern is with the good life. What does it mean to be a good person?
Right.
What does it mean to live a good life? And,
right.
and how do you do it?
Right.
And really a lot of questions flow from that. So, you know, if you're asking, well, what does it mean to live a good life? Well, there are a number of things you're going to ask. So, you know, what is required of you? What does it mean to say that a human being is flourishing? What do you do with the disconnect, let's say, between happiness in life versus goodness in life, mm-hmm. right? So it seems like there mm-hmm. should be some kind of matchup between the two, but there often isn't. How do we account for this? Is this some kind of an argument for there being a God in an afterlife? That was famously Kant's argument
right.
for there being a God in an afterlife, that mm-hmm. that there ought to be justice, but we don't see it on earth, so
perhaps
we have a reason to think that this would require there to be an afterlife where this would be kind of evened out and a God who underwrites this afterlife and so on. But anyway, so another question is, well, what's the nature of a human being?
Yes.
Right? So if we're talking about what is the good for a human, well, is there some nature? Is there something that makes us
right.
human? And some,
because that distinction has been blurred more and more.
Of course,
right?
Right.
What does it mean to be human? We're just one species of a number. And so is there something that philosophy can help us as a doorway to understand more about what it means to be human?
That's right. Or is there really humanness as
yes.
opposed to, you know, this human being and that human being and that human being with no common nature?
Correct.
So all of these things are, again, part of the subject matter of philosophy. But again, trying to figure out, well, is there a human anthropology? Is there something that it is to be human? Is there a human mm-hmm. nature that transcends, let's say, just bodily stuff?
Yes.
So again, all of these broad branches of philosophy flow from this pursuit of what is it? What does it mean to be a good person? What is the good life, and so on? And how do you achieve this good life?
Well, one of the things that you often hear about, Dennis, is that philosophers, many believe that we begin with this tabula rasa, right? This Greek phrase that means it's a blank slate, and then others say, no, that's Yes, did I say Greek? Yeah. See, I'm looking at a Greek man, and yeah, the tabula rasa, of course, a Latin phrase, but the point is this blank slate belief versus right. the idea that as a human being, you're born with, you know, certain traits, certain qualities, that it's not a blank slate and truly, you know, something we thought for quite some time. What's the distinction there? And maybe where do you land on that specific question? Are our kids, our grandkids, are they truly born with zero and it's just what they get exposed to in life? Or is there something that makes them human?
Right. I mean, that was... It had its moment in the sun. I think very, very few people would subscribe to a tabula rasa theory in philosophy or in other disciplines as well. I think Steven Pinker, who's a psychologist primarily, but one who dabbles in philosophy, wrote a book kind of just rejecting this, just tout court. I mean, entirely, another Greek phrase. sorry.
Sorry, the French, I think.
Yes, that's right. So yeah, I mean this idea. I mean, it was again kind of an attempt to liberate oneself from tradition and from this idea that, you know, you need to be this, you know, that you're born and you're born into this family, and so this family dictates what you're going to do, and your parents were, you know, your father was a bricklayer, so you're going to be a bricklayer, and you know, you have this, and it's also a little bit of an anti-religious tone to it that, you know, by virtue of Christianity, that, you know, this is what's right, this is what's wrong, and so everything is kind of laid out. And so it's a rebellion in part against that. Mm-hmm. You know, this idea that, well, no, just, you know, it's again, what you're impressed on, right? So if you're born in Christian Europe, well, by golly, you'll be a Christian, but hey, if you're born over here, then you'll have these completely different sets of beliefs about religion, about ethics, and so on. And it just doesn't seem to hold up. I mean, so that there are these cultural universals, there are ethical universals.
Such as? Cultural universals, like what?
Well, so there aren't any cultures, as far as I'm aware, where being a coward is considered to be a good thing. For instance, love, you know, respect for parents is you know, it doesn't mean that every person respects their parents, but right. I mean that this is considered to be a good, a foundation, and there are a number of others as well. I think Jordan Peterson has written on this among other people. So these cultural differences arguments don't seem to hold up. So I wouldn't consider myself a blank slatist either.
But you know, you brought up a couple of words like flourishing and happiness. You know, this idea that deeply in the American psyche is the idea of the pursuit of happiness. And yet when you think about psychologists and the study, I often hear from students, it's boring. Philosophers are... They're depressing. You know, they talk about existentialist stress. You know, they commit suicide. They even wonder if the myth of Sisyphus isn't truly a metaphor for our entire existence. You're smiling and laughing, but, you know, Francis Bacon said, here's the problem with philosophy. Philosophers found a way to get us into the forest, but no way out. So here you are being an apologist for your philosopher brothers and sisters. What about that? How do you rescue philosophy from those dredges of darkness?
I'm going to throw some of them under the bus. So, I mean, there are depressing philosophers.
Oh, great.
I mean, but that's kind of the nature of the thing. Mm. I mean, it's you know, it's an adversarial discipline, and there are lots of different ways in which philosophers see the world. So there isn't really philosophy as a unified body of knowledge.
Right.
When it becomes unified, it tends to kind of form its own sub-discipline, which sometimes just becomes its own discipline. Mm. Right. So psychology used to be a branch of philosophy. Physics was a branch, right? So Isaac Newton, what was his position? Do you know?
His, like, official title
yes,
and position?
That's right.
I've read it and I don't recall.
The Lucasian professor of
natural
philosophy.
Oh, was he? Natural philosophy?
Yeah, of natural philosophy. Mm-hmm. So, again...
Not surprising.
Right. So when you have, let's say, a sufficiently unified body, it kind of becomes its own discipline. We say, see, these philosophers, they're all... Mm. Right, all they do is disagree. Well, but that's kind of what keeps it as, let's say, pure philosophy. Mm. Mathematics, too, another... kind of
sure. Going back to Pythagoras, right?
Right, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But even let's say the Boolean algebra that computer mm-hmm. scientists learn, that's studied in philosophy as well. Mm-hmm. So anyway, all that to say that philosophy, if something's still in philosophy, there's lots of argument, and there are different styles of it. So there are styles that I like, mm-hmm. and there are subtopics that I like, and there are conclusions that I draw. But, you know, you find nine other philosophers, and they may have nine other different approaches and so on. But I think for those who want to look at philosophy and see that, no, there's a liveliness to it. There's an attractiveness. I mean, one of the best places to start would be with Plato's dialogues. Mm. Read, let's say, the five dialogues of the death, you know, the trial and death of Socrates.
You would say that those are the most approachable works of Plato's?
They're very approachable. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Socrates is just an incredibly appealing figure. Mm. I mean, you read the guy, he's a martyr for philosophy.
Right. Well, some say he wasn't a great philosopher, and had he not been martyred, he probably wouldn't be counted among the top three. Would you agree?
No, I think we say top three. I mean, as in any discipline, right? So, I mean, if you look at what doctors of the medieval period and the ancient period did, you'd be horrified to think, I'll never go to a doctor.
Right.
So, of course, there are developments both in terms of what we know, or at least what we take ourselves to know or to be justified in believing, and in terms of technique, right, in terms of, you know, just the rigor and the development of logic and so on. So, in that sense, yeah, I mean, Socrates is not going to stand up in terms of, like, the output, just in the same way that you know, an old track and field athlete's not going to be able to race with Usain Bolt, and an old chess player is not going to be able to compete on an even level with today's chess players. But but that said, I mean, you read him, and there's still an incredible attractiveness to the guy, where he's really willing to follow the argument where it leads. I mean, so his life is really his philosophy. I mean, there isn't a distinction. Mm. So he's not an 8-to-5 philosopher, and then he goes and does whatever he wants, you know, after he's finished with his job. I mean, he really believes the thing, and ultimately he's willing to die for it.
Well, in our last few minutes here, I think you've brought up several things. Here we are, Dennis, week after week, show after show, watching the skies, and we bring our personal philosophies to this world. And when we think about what's happening in the Middle East, in the Ukraine, world leaders, you know, I think often of Cuba, your own connection to Greece, Venezuela, the way it's collapsed. Of course, what I'm getting at here is each of these leaders, and even decision-making now at the highest levels, are based upon philosophical views of what is good and what are the right next steps. So maybe you can, in the last minute or so that we have, help our readers. You gave them great advice about how to get introduced to at least Socrates through Plato's work. Maybe another suggestion about a website, perhaps, or another way to introduce them to philosophy in a way that they could understand even further why it's something that they should consider continuing to study or be interested in.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because I think, to be honest, that the intro material out there is generally from points of view that I'm not always excited about or science that gets a little too academic. A former professor of mine has written some books where he tries to make philosophy, well, to quote the title, Philosophy Made Slightly Less Difficult,
okay,
which is not the most, you know, attractive
appealing
title, but he's a philosopher I definitely like, a fellow named J.P. Moreland.
Oh, sure.
Dallas Willard, who we've mentioned numerous times. Mm-hmm. Willard's not an easy read, but I mean, he's a great philosopher, so, I mean, he has a book called The Disappearance of Moral Knowledge, which I think is extremely relevant. But he does write kind of densely.
It's dense,
so,
the density of philosophy.
Yeah, a more contemporary work, if it's still around and they haven't updated it with a different author, Thomas Morris in the Philosophy for Dummies series is a very nice book.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of the intro stuff out there I don't really like, so that's kind of tough. But you can find a lot of podcasts out there as well. From a Christian standpoint, there's a philosopher, it kind of makes me cringe because he calls his show, I think his name is, I don't remember his name, but it's he calls it, you know, Pensées instead of Pensées. Like, oh, no. But but he has really good interviews with professional philosophers.
Okay. Pensees. So
yes.
We'll direct folks
right
to
so,
that.
So yeah, he has his first name first, and it's a P first name.
It's not
Pascal's. But,
right.
But but that's a pretty good podcast.
Good.
That covers a lot of really interesting philosophical work.
Great. Well, in your typical fashion, Dennis, you were able to evade some of my questions. I appreciated the fact that you didn't, you know, falsely support philosophy in a fashion where there are, you know, no cracks in it whatsoever. And so we do ask you to write to us at president@ashland.edu. We'll still be receiving your emails despite the fact this is our last day of programming. And as always, we thank you for joining us here on the Watchers of the Skies program. We'll see you next time.